Have you ever felt like you're, standing on really shaky ground when you're dealing with giant financial institutions? Maybe you're running a small business, or maybe you've put your own assets, your home even, on the line to help someone else out. And suddenly those complex agreements, they just feel overwhelmingly tilted against you. It's a powerful and often pretty terrifying experience. Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're not just diving into history. We're trying to uncover what seems like a stark truth. It's been 6 years since Australia's banking sector faced its biggest reckoning, the Financial Services Royal Commission. And our source material for this deep dive, it delivers a really blunt assessment. Essentially, nothing meaningful has changed. We want to show you why by unpacking some of the, frankly, shocking practices exposed back in 2018 and asking what this lack of progress really implies for, well, for you.
It's a really critical starting point, that 2018 article. It's our lens for this deep dive. And it just lays bare issues that weren't just pervasive, they were deeply damaging. The Royal Commission hearings, they weren't just headlines flying around. They were a moment when the public finally got a proper glimpse into practices that had perhaps been hidden for a long time, or maybe just ignored.
You've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. That atmosphere around the 2018 Royal Commission hearings, it wasn't just palpable, it felt charged, didn't it? Fueled by this genuine sense of public shock as, layer after layer of what many people saw as unethical banking practices were brought into the light.
And that shock was completely justified, especially when you look at what senior figures and even earlier inquiries had already been hinting at. Take Senator David Fawcett, for instance. Back in 2016, he actually chaired a parliamentary inquiry. It looked into the impairment of small business borrowers, basically, how banks could devalue or increase the risk assigned to their loans, often leading straight to default. His findings were, well, stark. He came away from that inquiry convinced that some small businesses were, and these are his words, set up to fail by the very system, by the way the banks operated.
Set up to fail. Wow, that's a profoundly disturbing accusation. How could banks or the system actually manage that?
That's precisely what Senator Fawcett dug into.
Yeah.
He observed that the loan contracts themselves were completely asymmetric, which means they gave an overwhelming amount of power to the banks, leaving very little recourse for the person borrowing the money.
Right. Skewed from the start.
Exactly. And he noted this really unsettling discrepancy. Bank staff would often provide these optimistic valuations when they were selling the loans, painting a very rosy picture. But then their internal credit departments could turn around and apply dramatically different valuations to those exact same assets when it came time to foreclose.
So good value when you borrow, bad value when they want to take it back.
Pretty much. And he explicitly stated, and this is a powerful quote, was that illegal? No. But was the way that they then subsequently dealt with those people unethical? Absolutely. This apparently became much more common after the global financial crisis, the GFC, back in 2008, when banks really tightened their loan books. And that tightening led to this surge of complaints from small businesses who felt their basic rights were just being steamrolled by what they called unfair provisions buried in their contracts.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. The article brings these systemic issues to life with specific case studies. They put faces and homes to these problems. Which of these examples do you think most starkly illustrates what we're talking about here?
Oh, without a doubt, the individual stories really underscore the immense human cost involved. We could start with the allegations against Commonwealth Bank, CBA, relating to its takeover of BankWest during the GFC. The claim was pretty explosive, that CBA deliberately defaulted customers of BankWest after buying it.
Deliberately. That's huge.
It is. Now, CBA, for its part, strongly denied any wrongdoing. But it's quite telling that the former Attorney General, Philip Ruddock, who was actually part of Senator Fawcett's inquiry, he held a very different view. He openly stated his belief that CBA acted inappropriately. That's not just a minor disagreement. It's a pretty significant figure questioning the ethics of a major bank.
And it wasn't just about these big corporate maneuvers, was it? The personal impact, as you said, was devastating. The article really highlights Carolyn Flanagan's harrowing experience with Westpac. She acted as a guarantor for her daughter's Pool Works franchise loan. When the business unfortunately struggled, Mrs. Flanagan, despite her best efforts, lost her own home.
Yeah, that's just heartbreaking.
She claimed she had been misled by the bank right from the beginning. She even took her case to the Financial Services Ombudsman, but, well, she wasn't successful there. Now, Westpac did eventually grant her a lifetime tenancy in the home, which is a significant gesture, you have to say.
Yeah.
But her experience left her with a searing warning, one that still really echoes. Her quote in the article is powerful. Never trust them, otherwise you will lose your home. It's just a chilling reminder of the personal stakes, isn't it?
Absolutely. What's fascinating here is how these individual cases, like Ms. Flanagan's, alongside the broader inquiries, they all consistently pointed towards these fundamental power imbalances and towards deeply ingrained problematic bank practices. Kate Carnell, she was the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman at the time she voiced serious concerns about this, what she called the alleged power imbalance. She highlighted that banks, rather than sort of truly partnering with or supporting small businesses through tough times, often seem focused almost purely on, well, their own risk and profitability.
So if I'm hearing you right, it wasn't really about fostering partnership or mutual success. It was more about just safeguarding their own bottom line, even if it meant a business went under.
Precisely. And a key mechanism she identified was something called non-monetary default. This is a concept that might sound a bit odd to many people. It means businesses could actually be defaulted on their loans even if they were still making all the required payments on time.
Wait, even if they're paying what they owe? How does that work?
It wasn't about financial delinquency in the usual sense. It was about other conditions, sometimes quite vague conditions, buried in the loan contract that gave the bank the power to just declare a default. Joseph Healy, he's a former senior exec at National Australia Bank, NAB, and later co-founded Judo Capital, an alternative lender, he articulated this unequal relationship with real clarity. He pointed out that the big four banks in Australia hold something like close to 85% of all small and medium-sized business lending.
85%? Wow, that's an incredible concentration of power, isn't it? It means there's almost no genuine competition, very little leverage for the borrower.
You've nailed the core issue right there. Healy explained that because of this market dominance, most small businesses, while they don't negotiate but have to accept the terms and conditions offered, they simply lack the bargaining power to push back on clauses, even the really problematic ones.
So you just sign on the dotted line.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And he elaborated further on this non-financial default idea with a really vivid example. Imagine a bank suddenly takes a particular view on an industry, let's say retail pharmaceuticals. Suddenly, all the loans within that entire sector, regardless of how well they had performed, could come under intense scrutiny. And there's a very real immediate risk of those loans just being withdrawn.
So it's not about your business failing to pay. It's about the bank changing its mind about your whole industry.
Exactly. It shows how a bank's internal policy shift, not a business's actual performance, could be the trigger for catastrophe. It can pull the rug out from under otherwise perfectly healthy businesses.
And the human cost of these systemic issues, like you said before, that's what really hits home. The article wraps up this section with Dario Pappalardo's dispute with NAB. It was so harrowing, it eventually caught the eye of the Royal Commission itself. He was a property developer in Melbourne. His funding for an apartment project just got frozen, bang, mid-2008. He said he never really got a straight answer why.
It sounds like a tragic, almost Kafkaesque situation, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A business just suddenly brought to its knees without any clear, transparent explanation. One day, everything's moving forward. The next, the funding's gone. Poof.
Exactly. Construction just stopped. He got transferred to the bank's restructuring division, despite family members stepping in, helping financially, even borrowing against their own property to try and support him. He was ultimately declared bankrupt by a creditor. He lost his building license, and his family is still, to this day, repaying the debt that was incurred.
Oh, that's just awful. Still repaying it now.
Yeah. His description of being caught in the bank's default mechanism is incredibly evocative. He called it being like a sand trap. The more you struggled, the deeper you sank.
A powerful image.
It is. Now, a spokesperson for NAB did offer a general comment in response, you know, stating the bank works with customers to find solutions when they have difficulty repaying debts. Standard line. But for Mr. Pappalardo and probably countless others like him, the scars are still there. It's just a powerful lived testament to those power imbalances we've been discussing. So, okay. We've looked back at these revelations from 2018, the asymmetric contracts, the huge power imbalances, those insidious non-monetary defaults, and the devastating human cost. We've seen these issues laid bare. Now, we really have to confront the crucial overarching question that frames this whole deep dive. So what does this all mean? What has actually changed in the 6 years since the Royal Commission and these stories first came to light? Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the source material we're looking at offers a really stark, frankly, quite sobering conclusion. In a commentary footnote, it states, with chilling directness, it has been 6 years and three federal elections since the Royal Commissioner Hayne handed its final report, and nothing meaningful has changed. That's not just an observation. It feels like an indictment of the system's resistance to real reform.
Nothing meaningful has changed. That's a really powerful statement, isn't it? And frankly, quite alarming, especially after such a high-profile inquiry, all that public outrage. It just forces us to ask, why? Why hasn't anything changed?
It truly does. And this raises a really important question, I think, for all of us listening. If the very core issues that caused so much damage and distress back then, things like the asymmetric contracts, the immense power imbalance favoring the banks, the use of non-monetary defaults, this perceived disregard for the human impact, if those were so clearly prevalent and exposed in 2018, what does this six-year lag actually imply about the underlying dynamics? You know, the fundamental relationship between the financial sector and small businesses.
Yeah, what does it tell us?
It forces us to think critically about why significant systemic change might be so incredibly slow or maybe even absent, despite all that intense public scrutiny, yeah. Despite a royal commission. Is it just the sheer scale of these institutions? Is it the complex web of regulations that maybe often favors the powerful? Or perhaps it's just a lack of sustained political will to really tackle these deeply entrenched problems.
Hmm.
The source doesn't give us easy answers, of course. But its conclusion definitely points towards a system that, in really fundamental ways, seems to have resisted profound transformation. It suggests the issues exposed weren't just a few bad apples, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They appear to be inherent structural flaws that are still there. They persist.
And this brings us back to you, the listener. Why should you care about this historical context and its, well, its enduring relevance today? Look, whether you're a small business owner, maybe navigating a new loan application right now, or perhaps you're thinking about acting as a guarantor for someone else's venture, or even if you're just engaging with banks as a regular customer, understanding these historical patterns, understanding the persistent power dynamics that are still at play, it seems absolutely critical.
Yeah, absolutely.
Recognizing the systemic issues that seem to continue to impact individuals and small businesses might just help you approach those financial relationships with, well, greater awareness, and hopefully maybe find better protection. It's really about arming yourself with knowledge, isn't it? Especially when you feel like you're facing what seems like a financial behemoth. So we've journeyed through the shocking findings of the Australian Financial Services Royal Commission from 2018. We've uncovered the stories, the asymmetric power, the questionable practices, the profound human impact on small businesses. And now we've had to face this sobering reality presented right there in our source material. Despite all that scrutiny, the claim is nothing meaningful has changed in the 6 years since.
Which leaves us with a really compelling, maybe even provocative thought to consider. Given how deeply entrenched these issues seem to be right across our essential financial industries, what does it actually take to shift these monumental power dynamics? What does it really require? And perhaps even more critically for you listening, how can individuals better equip themselves when navigating such a complex and often inherently unequal financial relationships, especially when the scales just seem so heavily weighted against them?
That's definitely a question worth mulling over long after this deep dive ends. We really encourage you to reflect on it and perhaps, you know, explore those questions further on your own.